in 2016. There was talk about a podcast election in 2020. I heard that phrase again. Is it more accurate this year? Is 2024 actually the podcast election?
That is CNN's Brian Stelter, as always, asking the hard-hitting, thoughtful questions very few people are brave enough to ask these days. And you heard me right, by the way. That is CNN's Brian Stelter. CNN did have the wherewithal to fire him a few years ago for being, and I don't say this lightly, the stupidest person on CNN. But of course, they were also stupid enough to give him his old job back now that CNN is on its third president in as many years and is apparently scrambling for programming after a series of high-profile scandals and cancellations. One of which, as I'm sure you're all sick of hearing by now, led to me being laid off earlier this year. I should pause here to say, hi again, this is Russ Finkelstein, your host of the New Yorker political scene. I played that clip just now not just to pick on Brian Stelter, though rest assured, I'm sure I'll be doing plenty of that now that he's back on CNN. But I played that clip because for some reason, this week's political scene was basically just the New Yorker feed re-airing an episode of Stelter's podcast that's called Inside the Hive, which from what I gather involves Stelter going inside the Harris campaign. Now, even a pervert like myself, sick as I may be, could not subject myself to listening to the entire episode of that. And there's plenty of other stuff I'd like to cover, including, of course, the previous episode of the New Yorker political scene, which was supposed to be a recap of the presidential debate between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, but ended up mostly being a love fest for Republican strategist and ex-husband of Kellyanne Conway, George Conway. That's right, George is single again, ladies. He and Kellyanne got divorced last year. Now, I don't know why the Washington Roundtable crowd, comprised of Evan Osnos, Susan Glasser, and Jen Mayer, skipped their episode this week. The only thing I can think of is that they're laying low and hoping that I've gone away for good. I don't know. Before we get to George Conway and the political scene's recap of the debate, there's a few other things I'd like to talk about first. So I try to do this podcast every week, but as some of you who have written to me apparently noticed, I did not post an episode last week. This had to do in part with a series of out-of-town guests who were staying with me and my wife here in our apartment in New York, and one of them told me a chilling story I think is relevant to something I wanted to delve into today. This friend of mine, who is in a high-level position of a global company, told me that his company made the decision to hire someone for a specific project, but then later, someone from the company went onto that person's Instagram feed and saw some posts that basically said something to the effect of Free Palestine, and that those mostly innocuous posts led to a conversation at the company, who then determined it would be too big of a risk to have this person be a part of a major project with pro-Palestinian views that were publicly visible. Now, my friend says the company then removed this person from the project without telling them that that decision was made because of their posts in support of Palestine. As I've already mentioned, I got laid off from CNN earlier this year, and since being laid off, I've started this podcast and have also been a lot more vocal on social media and elsewhere about my own criticism of Israel and support for the Palestinian cause, and wouldn't you know it, I haven't yet found any permanent long-term employment. Now, I have no reason to believe those two things are connected, but neither did this person. I think when I imagined being canceled for holding views that go against the status quo, I imagined I would at least get the closure of knowing that I'm paying some sort of a cost for expressing my political beliefs, but I guess it feels more dystopian in a way to have to go through life largely unaware of that cost. And I think this anecdote furthers one of my central theses on this podcast, that power perpetuates itself and even unpopular policies, like the U.S.'s support for Israel, which has grown increasingly unpopular over the past year since October 7th, isn't itself enough to change or thwart that policy, because those who dissent from it are systematically silenced and marginalized and basically kept away from power. Again, I don't know that that's happening to me, but this story my friend told me makes it seem plausible. What is one of the first things you do now when you meet someone socially or professionally? You Google them, right? And scroll through their social media profiles. Of course, the entire journalism industry is in crisis, and a lot of journalists I know are out of work right now, but I think it might be worth considering when you examine the types of people who do find themselves in prominent media jobs. Now, all this led me to the so-called return of the great Black American writer and thinker Ta-Nehisi Coates. Most of you will probably remember him from his essays in the Atlantic magazine, most notably, of course, The Case for Reparations, about which he also testified before Congress. He also wrote a tremendously influential book, Between the World and Me, which retraces his life as a young black man growing up in West Baltimore and his trajectory into the upper echelons of American intellectual institutions after studying at the historically black college, Howard University, which coincidentally is where Kamala Harris went to college also. Now, Ta-Nehisi Coates sort of left political discourse behind years ago. He quit Twitter in 2017 after a very public spat with Cornel West, who's also running for president this year. He then left The Atlantic magazine in 2018 and basically had dedicated himself to writing Black Panther comics and developing scripts for Hollywood until he started working on a new nonfiction book called The Message. That book looks at three places, but most notably the West Bank and the treatment of Palestinians there by the Israeli occupying forces. Coates apparently traveled to Israel and the West Bank last year to do reporting for his book, and that trip has apparently radicalized him to the point where he says he has very little interest in anything else these days. I, for one, found that very relatable. It's why, despite the fact that when I set out to make this podcast, I wanted to follow and respond to the conversations taking place on the New Yorker's political scene, but have since found myself basically every week doing a lot more on what's happening in the Middle East and the US's role in it. I think it's worth pointing out here, I also traveled to Israel for about 10 days, more than 25 years ago, for my bar mitzvah when I was 13. Now, as I'm sure a lot of people know, a lot of Jewish kids go on what's called birthright, which, first of all, it's a crazy name, isn't it? Birthright. Like, it's my right because I was born Jewish to just go to Israel on a fully paid vacation. And that basically sums up what the point of the trip is for the people who pay for it. It's an incredibly popular thing for Jews to do, mostly when they're in college. And they get a free trip to Israel, which consists of a tour of the country, the military bases, the historic sites, the Holocaust Memorial Museum, and a good number of them end up hooking up with some hot Israelis or just other Jews on their trip, which for a lot of people ends up becoming the highlight. And the idea is you come back from that trip either with a desire to go join the Israeli military, which some people do end up doing, or at the very least, you return to America or to Europe or wherever else you might be from, ready to support Israel and the project of Zionism for the rest of your life. Now for me, I was originally supposed to have my bar mitzvah in a temple, and my family was a member of one in San Diego where I grew up. In the last year or so before your bar mitzvah, you have to take the seminar class with the rabbi. And I remember at the time, I had a lot of questions for the rabbi about the Torah and about Judaism in general. But over the course of that seminar, the rabbi grew increasingly impatient with my questions and would sometimes make me go sit outside out of frustration. Now, as an adult, it seems funny because Judaism is nothing if not asking questions and debating things, but this particular rabbi was not having any of it. I remember one day the rabbi said something like, "And after the floods, Noah lived to be 950 years old," or something like that. Of course, my hand shot up and I said, "Rabbi, how do you expect anyone to believe that? It doesn't make any sense. Have you ever seen a 100-year-old? He had already had it up to here with me that day, so he sent me outside. Now this temple, Beth Israel it's called, is in downtown San Diego, in what used to not be the greatest neighborhood. When my mom came to pick me up that day, she found me sitting outside in the parking lot. I was 12 years old, and I'm not sure what she said to who, but suffice to say she did her share of yelling, and after that we never went back to Beth Israel. And so instead, my family went and found a freelance Hebrew tutor to prepare me for my bar mitzvah outside the temple. And eventually the plan became, I'll work with the freelance tutor, learn my Torah portion, and then go with my extended family to Israel for this free trip. Because as a Jew, you can get that free trip whenever you want. So my family decided to use it for my bar mitzvah and make a vacation out of it for my entire extended family. Also, my cousin, who's about the same age as me and had already had her bat mitzvah, decided to do her bat mitzvah again so we could both get the free trip. And another family friend also did the same thing, lied, said he was doing his bar mitzvah for the first time, and also got a free trip out of it. So off we go to Israel, 15 or so Finkelsteins plus a few family friends in a tour bus, going all over Israel with a tour guide, and usually accompanied by a very sexy IDF soldier. And we went to historic sites, we went to the beaches, we ate shawarma and falafel. I remember they put French fries in the shawarma sandwich, which my family thought was amazing. And it was a really nice family vacation. The day before my bar mitzvah, we went to the Dead Sea and floated there. which, if you're 13 years old, is basically the coolest thing you could possibly imagine. You're so buoyant, you're floating well above the water without even trying. It's really fucking cool. And then we woke up the next day at like 3 in the morning, and we climbed up this mountain called Masada, which is where our bar mitzvah was going to take place. Now, Masada is famous because it's the place where hundreds of Jews committed mass suicide to avoid being captured by the conquering Romans about 2,000 years ago. So we climb up there, and we're told to wear all white. So I'm in white sweatpants and a white sweatshirt. And we get to the top of this mountain just as the sun is rising, which is really beautiful, but also feels kind of somber at the same time. And you're made very aware of the fact that you're doing your bar mitzvah there because of this tragic history. Anyway, I read my Torah portion in Hebrew, and then after that, we walk back down the mountain, and I shit you not, they drive us straight to an IDF airbase and show us a bunch of fighter jets and artillery and tanks and shit. And it was very clear in my 13-year-old mind that this was a sales pitch. That the tragedy my people faced 2,000 years ago on Masada was why we needed to have this military base, which was meant to prevent that sort of thing from ever happening again. At least according to this narrative that's being fed to us. And even though I was just a kid, feeling that I was being sold a bill of goods and passing by places where you could see Palestinians either off in the distance in what looked to be less prosperous towns or in an old market where they were also seemingly existing as second-class citizens, I got the sense that this whole tour I was on was designed to convince me that the Jews needed to dominate the land and the Arabs for the sake of our own security, and that this military might we were being shown was not only justified but righteous and somehow sacred. One of the things I'm proudest of when I look back on that is how repellent I found that. And you can ask any of the other members of my family who were on that trip who found my feedback on what was happening offensive and ungrateful. Anyway, it's what I was reminded of while reading this interview with Ta-Nehisi Coates about his new book in New York Magazine. The headline of that piece is, "The Return of Ta-Nehisi Coates, A Decade After the Case for Reparations. He is ready to take on Israel, Palestine, and the American media." Now, apparently Coates' new book is not just a critique of Israel and the U.S.'s support for it. It also appears to be a bit of a self-critique, written by someone who ascended to the upper echelons of American journalism, but now finds himself looking at that milieu in disgust because of their silence about or whitewashing of the truth about Israel. Reading from the article here. Later that summer, just after he returned to the U.S., Coates introduced himself to the Palestinian-American historian Rashid Khalidi at Columbia, who invited Coates and his wife to dinner to discuss his trip. Quote, "I think he felt he had been conned," Khalidi told me, "and I think he felt he had to, I don't think atone is the right word, but make up for what he had mistakenly believed." So Coates began his education in earnest, with Khalidi guiding him through the literature in a running dialogue that lasted months. It was a process not dissimilar to his preparation for The Case for Reparations. Coates leaned on family, friends, experts, Jews and Arabs, and others to stress test and expand his ideas. In interviewing journalists about Coates and his work, I got the sense that taking the Palestinian side, or even talking about the issue at all, invited significant risk to one's credibility and career, part of a constant policing of the parameters of acceptable discourse on the subject. Now, of course, there are a lot of people who are paying a serious price for expressing criticism of Israel, a lot more than what Coates may suffer from his new book. He, of course, already has an established career, best-selling books, Hollywood development deals, and the like, which is why the next paragraph in this article got a bit of criticism from pro-Palestinian activists, and I think rightfully so. Quote, "The fact of the matter is," Coates said, "that kid up at Columbia, whatever dumb shit they're saying, whatever slogan I would not say that they would use, they are more morally correct than some motherfuckers that have won Pulitzer Prizes and National Magazine Awards and are the most decorated and powerful journalists." So, as I've discussed on this podcast, I do think Coates is absolutely right that award-winning journalists, including the hosts of the New Yorker political scene and countless others, are on the wrong side of the issue when it comes to Israel. But I think it's unfortunate he said that the protesters at Columbia were, quote, "saying dumb shit or using slogans he would not say." Not that you couldn't find something I disagree with coming from the mouths of those protesters, but why concede that when you're trying to make a point about right and wrong? Anyway, I think Coates is mostly right here, and he goes on. "What I suspect is that American media in general thinks of itself as separate from the ends and goals of American power, and I don't think that's true. I have a deep-seated fear, he said, that the black struggle will ultimately, at its root, really just be about narrow black interests. And I don't think that is in the tradition of what our most celebrated thinkers have told the world. I don't think that's how Martin Luther King thought about the black struggle. I know that's not how Du Bois thought about the black struggle. I know that's not how Baldwin thought about the black struggle. Should it turn out that we have our first black woman president and our first South Asian president, and we continue to export 2,000-pound bombs to perpetrate a genocide in defense of a state that is practicing apartheid, I won't be able to just sit here and shake my head and say, well, that is unfortunate. I'm going to do what I can in the time that remains and the writing I have to not allow that to be, because that is existential death for the black struggle and for black people, as far as I'm concerned. Personally, I have been a fan of Ta-Nehisi Coates' writing in the past, and I think some of what he says here is incredibly poignant and thoughtful, and I applaud him for that. And I do think his intervention here, not just with this interview, but with his book, does represent a turning point among American liberals when it comes to Israel. I really do think we're seeing the most substantial shift in American public opinion on Israel, at least in my lifetime, and maybe even in my parents' lifetime. And I am very curious about what he means by saying he's going to do what he can in the time that remains with regard to the potential election of Kamala Harris. I'm very curious to see what he means by that and how it might unfold. Now let's check back in on CNN anchors Dana Bash and Jake Tapper, who have really humiliated themselves this week after having to clarify comments they made smearing Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib over completely invented accusations of anti-Semitism. I'm reading from an article written by Natasha Leonard in The Intercept. The headline, CNN anchors won't stop lying about something Rashida Tlaib never said. In the last 3 days, CNN host Jake Tapper and Dana Bash have performed a master class in journalistic malpractice, better described in this case as lying. Both anchors devoted concerted airtime to accusing Representative Rashida Tlaib of anti-Semitism based on a comment they attributed to the Palestinian-American member of Congress, a comment she never came close to making. Anyone watching CNN's State of the Union with Tapper on Sunday or Inside Politics with Dana Bash on Monday would have heard that Tlaib questioned Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel's ability to fairly do her job because Nessel is Jewish. Little matter to the primetime journalist that Tlaib's recent criticism of Nessel did not in any way mention or refer to the Attorney General's Jewish faith or identity. The lie stems from Tlaib's comments on Nessel's decision to prosecute 11 Gaza Solidarity protesters from the University of Michigan. The student demonstrators are facing overreaching criminal charges for camping out on their own college campus to protest the funding of Israel's genocidal war. Quote, "We've had the right to dissent, the right to protest," Tlaib told the Detroit Metro Times. "We've done it for climate, the immigrants' rights movement, for black lives, and even around the issue of injustice among water shutoffs. But it seems that the Attorney General decided if the issue was Palestine, she was going to treat it differently, and that alone speaks volumes about the possible biases within the agency she runs." Tlaib's accusation of anti-Palestinian bias, which is institutionally rampant nationwide, was immediately twisted by Nessel into an alleged anti-Semitic attack. Quote, "Rashida should not use my religion to imply I cannot perform my job fairly as Attorney General. It's anti-Semitic and wrong," wrote Nessel on X. Again, Nessel's religion was not mentioned. Now, I'm going to play the clip that Dana Bash played on her show, and it gets a little bit meta here because Dana Bash starts the segment with a bit of commentary and then throws to Jake Tapper's interview with Michigan's Governor Gretchen Whitmer, who Jake Tapper asks about Rashida Tlaib's comments, and he falsely insinuates that they're anti-Semitic.
"And now to a sad reality, and that is anti-Semitism is everywhere. And it comes from both ends of the political spectrum. But politicians sometimes sidestep calling it out when it comes from a member of their own party. We saw two examples on State of the Union yesterday. First, with Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, when my co-anchor, Jake Tapper, asked about a Democratic congresswoman's accusation that the state's Jewish attorney general was letting her religion influence her job.
Do you think that Tlaib's suggestion that Nestle's office is biased was anti-Semitic?
Listen, Jake, you know what? All I can say is that I know that our Jewish community is in pain, as is our Palestinian and Muslim and Arab communities in Michigan.
Congresswoman Tlaib is suggesting that she shouldn't be prosecuting these individuals that Nestle says broke the law, and that she's only doing it because she's Jewish, and the protesters are not. That's quite an accusation. Do you think it's true?
There's so much that's just absolutely insane about this clip that would really only ever happen if the person being slandered was Palestinian. First of all, both Tapper and Dana Bash take the Michigan Attorney General's word for it that Rashida Tlaib was accusing her of bias because she's Jewish. All they had to do was read Rashida Tlaib's quote to the Detroit Metro Times. But the other thing that I find really crazy about this is that Jake Tapper poses this question to Michigan's governor, who is a star of the Democratic Party, and comes at her with this completely fabricated lie about something Rashida Tlaib has said. As a producer who's worked on these types of interviews before, I would especially dig into research if I'm posing a challenging question to a prominent government official.
Like I said, Jake, I'm not going to get in the middle of this argument that they're having.
And then there was this exchange with Republican Senator Tom Cotton.
Are you comfortable with that? With Donald Trump saying if he loses preemptively, it's the fault of the Jews, a group already experiencing a rise of anti-Semitism in this country from the left and the right, but still preemptively, it's the fault of the Jews?
Well, Jake, Donald Trump has been saying things like this for at least 11 months since the October 7th attack.
I've never heard you say anything like that. If we lose, it will be the fault of the Jews.
But Jake, Donald Trump, again, has been saying for months that anyone who cares about Israel, anyone who cares about the fate of the U.S.-Israel alliance should vote for him.
I'm talking about Jewish voters who vote for any number of reasons on any number of issues.
And he was at an event talking about combating anti-Semitism here and around the world.
Just yes or no. Are you comfortable with him using that language?
Jake, it's the same kind of language he's been using for months.
That doesn't mean it's okay.
Yes, but it's his point. His point, Jake, he's the most pro-Israel president we've ever had.
Now, Jake asked that question over and over again. Senator Cotton never answered. Now, Cotton has spoken out when it appears to come from the political left. He actually tweeted, "There's no place for anti-Semitism in America," when Jake posted about people harassing yours truly at a book event.
Now, remember, we covered this on the last episode of this podcast. Dana Bash was not being protested because of her Jewish faith. She was being protested because of all the vile and disgusting things she said in her coverage of the war and people protesting the war here in the United States. It wasn't anti-Semitic at all. In fact, it was perfectly justified. Regardless, nice callback, Dana.
At a book event, CNN's David Chalian is back with me. I was grateful for that, as anybody who is the subject and the victim of anti-Semitism,
hate,
or any other hate. And the key is, which we have learned the hard way, is you gotta call it out no matter where it comes from.
Now, the lie being perpetuated by Dana Bash and Jake Tapper was so egregious that the person who wrote this article for the Detroit Metro Times, who interviewed Rashida Tlaib and quoted her in the article, actually fact-checked these CNN anchors. Going back to Natasha Leonard's article in The Intercept, Steve Neveling, the Metro Times reporter who interviewed Tlaib, on whose story the anti-Semitism claims are based, spent the last 2 days attempting to counteract the lies, tweeting at Tapper and Bash, publishing an explicit fact-check report in the Metro Times. "This is a lie," Neveling wrote on X in response to Tapper. "You're referring to a story I wrote for Metro Times, and U.S. Rep. Tlaib never said what you're saying she said." In a follow-up tweet responding to Bash's segment, Neveling wrote, "Now Dana Bash from CNN is lying about what happened. U.S. Representative Rashida Tlaib did not say Nestle filed the charges because she's Jewish. She said there is an anti-Palestinian attitude among many institutions, and most of them are not run by Jewish people." The governor, Gretchen Whitmer, faced further backlash from predictable corners. The Anti-Defamation League's Jonathan Greenblatt tweeted directly at Whitmer noting, quote, when a congresswoman accuses the attorney general of prosecuting protesters simply because she's Jewish, it's bias, he wrote. Now, I'm going to reread Rashida Tlaib's quote that's being called anti-Semitic because it's so apparent she doesn't say what all of these people are accusing her of having said. What she said was, quote, we've had the right to dissent, the right to protest. We've done it for climate, the immigrant rights movement, for Black lives, and even around the issues of injustice among water shutoffs. But it seems that the attorney general decided if the issue was Palestine, she was going to treat it differently, and that alone speaks volumes about possible biases within the agency she runs. That is all Rashida Tlaib said. But regardless, Whitmer then put out her statement, shared by Tapper on X, the suggestion that Attorney General Nessel would make charging decisions based on her religion as opposed to the rule of law is anti-Semitic, which is just crazy that Whitmer got dragged into piling on Tlaib over this complete fabrication. Anyway, at the time of this recording, neither Jake Tapper nor Dana Bash have actually apologized for what they said. They did, however, issue the following clarifications. Tapper's clarification came during an interview he did with Attorney General Nessel, where he basically invited her to double down on her baseless accusation that Rashida Tlaib accused her of being biased against the pro-Palestinian protesters because she's Jewish.
I should note that I misspoke yesterday when asking a follow-up of Governor Whitmer, who I asked about this. I was trying to characterize your views of Tlaib's comments. What do you make of those today, noting that Congresswoman Tlaib never explicitly said that your bias was because of your religion, and so it's unfair for you to make that allegation?
Clarification on a story we brought you yesterday concerning Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib's comments attacking a decision by Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel to bring charges against pro-Palestinian protesters at the University of Michigan. Tlaib accused Nessel of, quote, biases. Here's Tlaib's full quote to the Detroit Metro Times. It seems that the attorney general decided if the issue was Palestine, she was going to treat it differently. And that alone speaks volumes about possible biases within the agency she runs. Now, Tlaib did not reference Nessel's Jewish identity. Her office has not responded to our request for clarity. Her allies insist that's not what she meant. But Nessel still says she believes it is anti-Semitic and repeated on CNN yesterday that, quote, clearly she's referencing my religion.
One thing's clear after these clarifications, in lieu of what should have been apologies to Rashida Tlaib and to their audiences, Jake Tapper and Dana Bash are not good faith actors. They're really no better than Fox News anchors. They intentionally manipulated the story, then absconded their responsibility. But suffice to say, it's been pointed out to them, they're aware of what's happened, and this is how they choose to rectify things. As Tasha Leonard said, this is journalistic malpractice. Let's go now to the main event, the New Yorker political scene's recap of the presidential debate between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, featuring the one and only George Conway.
And I was making a list before this taping today of all of the ways in which Kamala Harris prosecuted the case against Trump by getting under his skin, taking, in effect, the psychological approach to Trump in that debate, which is something very different than certainly Joe Biden did in his various debates with Donald Trump. My list included, obviously, the rally comment, which we've already run a little bit of a tape of that. She dug at him for his inherited wealth. That really upset him.
The values I bring to the importance of home ownership, knowing not everybody got handed $400 million on a silver platter and then filed bankruptcy six times.
She talked very explicitly about that he was having trouble, quote, processing his DeVite, the language of psychiatry.
And clearly he is having a very difficult time processing that.
She said, and I thought this was very, you know, designed to poke at him and who he is. He said that Vladimir Putin would eat you for lunch.
And why don't you tell the 800,000 Polish Americans right here in Pennsylvania how quickly you would give up for the sake of favor and what you think is a friendship with what is known to be a dictator who would eat you for lunch.
That they're laughing at us around the world. She used his language and called him weak.
It is very well known that Donald Trump is weak and wrong on national security and foreign policy.
And then another one was the very beginning, getting in his physical space with the handshake that he was rattled by. And then, of course, the final one that I wrote on my list was, she said, Donald, you were fired.
Yes.
Donald Trump was fired by 81 million people. So let's be clear about that.
Again, using Trump's own words and languages.
So as you've just heard there, this episode of The New Yorker's political scene focuses on all of the ways that Kamala Harris has and can continue to get under Donald Trump's skin to provoke him. I guess to provoke an angry and erratic response from him. Now, the host of the podcast seemed to credit George Conway with coming up with the strategy in the first place, which seems a bit nuts to me. I remember 2015 and 2016. It was not really that long ago. And I think a lot of people were saying basically the same thing. Now, George Conway did have an interesting track on things because he was married to Kellyanne Conway at the time. But also, some important context for this conversation, he supported Donald Trump in the 2016 election. And despite all of the crazy shit Donald Trump said going into that election, George Conway thought he would make a good candidate. If you've noticed a trend here, you're not crazy. The hosts of the political scene love to have conservatives on this show, conservative Democrats, or even conservatives like Republicans on, to give the Harris campaign and Democrats advice about how to beat Donald Trump. Now, what's wrong with that? Most glaringly, it's that these people don't agree with anything the Harris campaign stands for. So the only advice they're willing to offer is either that Harris should run further to the right, or shit like this, like she needs to do a better job of getting under his skin.
You and I have talked about your origin story before as a professional Trumpologist. You've talked about reading a 2017 Rolling Stone article that was headlined, "Is Pathological Narcissism the Key to Trump's Behavior?" Why do you think you came to this insight? And it is an important insight. A lot of other people have had different and maybe less successful approaches to going after Trump. Why did you gravitate towards this?
Well, I don't take credit for it, because there are people who saw this before the rest of us. And the two groups of people in particular, from a professional standpoint, were shrinks, psychologists and psychiatrists, who were restricted in what they could say, or many of them believed that they are restricted in what they could say because of the Goldwater Rule, which is a whole other thing we could do a whole program about. And then people who act on or study history, which would include not just professional historians, but other social scientists and diplomats and military types, which is why you saw all the national security types come out in 2016 and say, this man is dangerous, because they saw him, you know, a reflection of the pages of history. Now, when I supported President Trump in 2016, my wife was, his campaign manager. I thought it was an amazing thing that she got this buffoon elected. But I didn't think he was going to be that bad, because I thought he'd surround himself with good people. He'd want to do a good job. In other words, I thought there was some, despite his screwiness, I thought there was some normality in there.
Now, imagine you are a writer for The New Yorker magazine, or for that matter, you're a Democratic operative, or maybe you work on the Harris campaign. Are you going to take advice from someone who in 2015 and in 2016 thought that the guy who called Mexicans rapists, the guy who said he was going to build a wall on the southern border, the guy who said he was going to ban Muslims from entering the country, are you going to take advice from someone who thought that that person who said all of that repugnant and hateful shit was going to make a good president? That is who George Conway is. He does not really take issue with Donald Trump's policies. He actually agrees with those policies, and he wants to see them implemented. So why would you ever listen to him? There's probably a few dozen Never Trump Republicans left in this country, George Conway being one of them. So he's not someone most Republicans really care to listen to, and he doesn't agree with anything Democrats stand for. But if you're an inside the Beltway journalist, for some reason, this is the intellectual space you keep coming back to.
I did believe very early on that the way to puncture him is to confront him with the truth about himself. And the first thing I ever wrote, I mean, I tweeted some stuff about it, and it got him very, very angry, which I tweeted about him being a narcissist and a sociopath in March of 2019, and it drew, they told him at the White House to shut up and don't amplify Conway. But of course he did. And he attacked me. I was the husband from hell. I was a loser. I was this, that, and the other thing. And it was like, and then I tweeted back, see, you've just shown everybody what narcissistic personality disorder is.
So besides the fact that George Conway has an agenda here, which is to push the Harris campaign and Democrats in general away from making a more progressive sales pitch to voters or proposing more progressive policies, the other reason why I find George Conway's advice silly is because it's like, okay, you poked the bear, you pissed off Donald Trump. How does that translate into votes against him? Now, you might say the more angry he gets, the more he lashes out and the more he turns voters off. We saw a bit of that in the debate, right? That's what they're talking about. I'm thinking mostly of the moment when Trump said that Haitians were eating people's pets in Ohio. That was crazy, but it remains to be seen that it'll actually hurt him politically. Now, I think most people polled did say they think he lost that debate, but just think about all the shit that's happened over the last couple months. There are a lot of real tangible things that could impact the outcome of the election, and a lot of those things are substantive and political. Of course, Conway's advice is limited by the fact that he's a conservative. That's why you don't hear him talking about policy at all in this conversation.
I mean, George, your PAC has a new ad out recently that really, it almost seems as if it is designed for an audience of one. I mean, literally, right?
Hey, Donald.
Governor Chris Sununu called Trump crazy, but he's...
All your friends, all the people that have worked with you.
He's a very, very flawed man.
They all think you're nuts.
The man cannot tell the truth, but he combines it with being a narcissist.
He's a populist, authoritarian narcissist.
Donald Trump is not fit to be president of the United States.
Our country can't be a therapy session for a troubled man like this.
Governor Sununu called Trump crazy and said if he was in a mental institution, he wouldn't get out.
So, I mean, do you have any sense of whether he sees these things?
Yeah, he does. I mean, first of all, look, when we first started running ads, He went on Truth Social and specifically attacked me and Fox News for putting my ads on his TV. And then, and this one, this is a little subtle, but it's really actually kind of amazing. In the introductory video for my PAC, which was like a 3 or 4 minute long thing, and it wasn't just a 30 second spot or one, it was like 4 or 5 minutes, a little too long, they say, but I liked it. One of the things I pointed out was that understanding his personality disorders is critical to understanding almost basically everything about Trump. To understand Donald Trump, why he's unfit for office, and why he's a danger to the Republic, you have to understand his psychological disorders, including his authoritarianism, his love of dictators, because he wants to be all-powerful like those people. He considers himself to be like Putin, like, or aspires to be like Kim Jong-un, and all the bad people in the world.
I'm not going to keep beating a dead horse here, but I just don't understand what makes Conway's insight and his contributions to our politics that remarkable. It seems like a pretty straightforward attack ad, like the kind you almost always see on TV during an election. I guess this one features people who used to work in the Trump White House. I don't know.
Do you think it actually matters politically, though? I mean, to me, that's the interesting question, right? Like, clearly it's a good thing as a general principle to have your opponent be off balance and defensive and, you know, sort of talking about himself as opposed to the country. But what does it mean in terms of, you know, electorally speaking? Does it matter, do you think, to voters?
Kudos to Susan Glasser here for asking the only good question in the duration of this episode.
Yeah, it does. And you just expressed the reason why. I mean, look, this election is going to be a close run thing no matter what, or you can expect it to be because of the way the nation is politically divided. But there are undecided voters or movable voters, including Republicans. And you don't have to move that many of them to bury Donald Trump. Okay. I mean, it was something like, the Lincoln Project used to say 4 years ago, they called it the Bannon line, which was basically Steve Bannon had basically said that all the Democrats need to do is move 5 or 10%, I forget what the percentage was, of Republicans, and Trump's a goner. And that still holds true.
Yeah. And on average, about 50% of the country doesn't vote. So if you can turn out more people with progressive left-wing policies that are widely popular, you only need 1 or 2% of those people who normally don't vote to actually turn out for you. And then that 5 to 10% of Republicans won't fucking matter. And Democrats could actually do the things they say they stand for.
Do you see this becoming, this idea of triggering political opponents, becoming part of our politics now? Or do you think it's specific to him and it sort of goes away?
Look, I mean, there always has been some of this in politics, you know, a little psychological warfare here and there, but it's usually just on the edges, on the margins for entertainment. And I hope it stays that way, because I want to get back to, like, I'd like to have a serious democracy where we talk about serious things in a serious way for serious things like an election.
Again, this is the guy who thought that Donald Trump would make a good president in 2016. These are the sorts of serious things that he hopes we could talk about during an election. Come on, man. Unfortunately, I do think that this dumbing down of our politics happened not just because Donald Trump's running for president, but because the political parties and the campaigns are captured by powerful interests. And so the battlefield of our politics shrinks, which is why our political system does not seem sufficient to address all of the real profound problems that we face. But to George Conway's credit, I guess it is kind of fun watching Donald Trump be provoked.
I truly and deeply hope that your expertise in this field of Trump studies may soon become, let's just say, something for the history books. But we are very grateful to have you with us. And we hope that if you're a guest a year from now, it's on a different subject.
You're supposed to be a journalist, Susan. Act like it. What is all this innuendo? You're saying you think you hope Trump loses? That does not sound like the kind of journalistic neutrality I expect from The New Yorker. And on that bitter note, I bid you farewell, my dear listener. Thanks for being with me on this extra beefy episode of The New Yorker Political Scene. I really do appreciate each and every one of you. If you're not subscribed to this podcast, please do so now and tell all your friends about it.
Oh, dear Lord. You made many, many poor people. I realize, of course, it's no shame to be poor, but it's no great honor either. So what would have been so terrible if I had a small fortune? If I were a rich man, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum, all day long I bidda-bidda-bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard. Yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum. If I were a bidda-bidda-rich idle-diddle-diddle-diddle man, I'd build a big tall house with the rooms by the dozen, right in the middle of the town. A fine tin roof with the real wooden floors below. There would be one long staircase just going up, and one even longer coming down, and one more leading nowhere just for show. I'd fill my yard with the chicks and turkeys and geese and ducks for the town to see and hear, squawking just as noisily as they can.